This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purcell. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Garbology, our dirty love affair with trash, coming up later on Cincinnati Edition. Thane Maynard, a 90-second naturalist, speaks with author Ed Humes about his book that explores America's love affair with trash. But before you roll that container to the curb, time to gaze upward at the stars and space. This weekend, the Cincinnati Observatory Center marks the 170th anniversary of the laying of the observatory's cornerstone by John Quincy Adams. The citizens of Cincinnati founded our nation's first public astronomical observatory right up the hill. There will be a special event on Sunday evening to mark that occasion. And on Saturday evening, you'll have the chance to meet a meteorite. Joining me in the studio to talk about those events and answer your questions about stargazing and so much more is Dean Regas, the outreach astronomer for the Cincinnati Observatory and co-host of Stargazers on PBS. Good to have you back on Cincinnati Edition, Dean.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Before we discover what's happening this weekend, let's head back in time to the 1840s to find out why the citizens of Cincinnati decided to build an astronomical observatory. You would think back in that day, they had a few other things on their mind just trying to survive.
Sure. I mean, this was way back in the beginning of our city. We're looking back 1843, and a gentleman by the name of Ormsby McKnight Mitchell had this wild idea to build an observatory here in Cincinnati. He was an astronomy professor, a good popularizer of the field. He gave talks downtown, and the legend is that they had 1,000 to 2,000 people at one of his talks when the population of Cincinnati was only about 40, 50,000. So at the end of one of the talks, somebody says, "Hey, Ormsby Mitchell, we should get a telescope for Cincinnati. You obviously can fire up a lot of people." So he went door to door asking people for $25 a piece. And with that money, he went to Munich, Germany, bought a telescope, shipped it all the way back over here to Cincinnati, and started building the observatory on Mount, what was called Mount Ida at the time, and Mount Adams today. And that's when John Quincy Adams entered our picture and changed the name of the hill forever.
Now, this isn't, just to clarify, not the first observatory in the United States. It was the first public observatory, correct?
Exactly. This is what made it different, is that by him going door to door, you actually contributed, you got a share of stock in the observatory, essentially. So you pay your $25, which was like a month's salary back then, and you get access to the observatory when it is built. That seems like kind of a far-fetched thing. So this guy comes to your door, says, "Hey, can I have a month or two salary for a telescope we don't have, for an observatory we haven't built?" What would you say? Well, he must have been a very dynamic guy, because he raised, you know, this money in a month and a half. And so this was very unique. All the observatories around the world were either the Tsar of Russia had a bigger one, the, you know, institutions, government institutions and colleges had one, but this was the first public, this was our people's observatory, we'd say.
Or if you're one of the people who've been to the Cincinnati Observatory and have a story to share or a question to ask, feel free to get in touch with us. You can call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Plus, you can tweet or make a post on Facebook, and we'll get those messages as well. Well, you mentioned John Quincy Adams. How did John Quincy Adams get involved, and why was he interested in what was happening with this public astronomical observatory?
Well, exactly. When he was president, he wanted to get a national observatory. He wanted to get a government-funded observatory to rival those in Europe. And so Congress was not interested in that. He had a very combative Congress that didn't want to do anything that he wanted to do. And so it might sound familiar to some other people.
I was going to say, oh, well.
But he couldn't get it done when he was in office. And so after he was out of office, he went back to Congress, which is kind of a unique thing. After being president, he was a congressman. And Mitchell from Cincinnati thought, well, this guy really wanted to get an observatory. Now that we're going to have one, he's the logical person to come. And so John Quincy Adams gets the request, and we have his response letter that he wrote back. It's very flowering language from the 1800s. You should see the way they read. Oh, the great honorable Ormsby Mitchell, thank you so much for, you know. And so he's 75 years old at this time, and he decides he's going to make the journey from Boston, from the Massachusetts, all the way over here to Cincinnati. And his friends, they just said, "John Quincy, no, don't go out to the West in the wild. They're Wild West out there. You'll never come back. And he said, I need to do this. And he made the epic journey, which was quite a big journey for anybody to go all the way to Cincinnati. That's when he saw the site. They climbed up the hill to Mount Ida at the time, and he gave his speech in the pouring rain of November. You guys know how it'd be in November. He gave his speech, and they renamed the hill in his honor after that.
And it really, Cincinnati was kind of the last bastion of civilization, the farthest west that there was kind of civilized. I mean, there were settlers who had moved further, but at that time, this was a long way from anywhere.
It was. Just to get from there to here, we took a train to Lake Erie, a boat across to Sandusky, and then he took canal boat, horseback. I mean, all the way just to get to Cincinnati was quite an adventure, that's for sure.
Well, so Melon Adams was named because of his involvement, and that wasn't the first time that the observatory played a role in naming a hill, because we'll get into that story in just a minute. But I wanted to ask, do we know where on today's Mount Adams that first observatory was? Do we know where it was located?
We know with pretty good certainty it was right around where the monastery is today. So if you picture that highest spot of land on Mount Adams, that was the site of the original observatory. When it was built, the Mount Adams was totally barren. I mean, all the trees were gone. They'd all been chopped down for wood and for houses. And so the view was great. I mean, you had a great sweeping view of the north, south, east, and west. When they erected it there, the city was still relatively small, but in 1840s, view was great. By 1860s, the city had expanded quite a bit, and the whole valley down there was filled with coal smoke and wood smoke, and so the observatory became pretty much unusable at the time.
I was going to say, I guess in the day, they didn't have to worry about light pollution or anything that astronomers worry so much about today. Instead, it was the coal smoke.
Exactly. No light pollution, but it is strange to think that there was more pollution probably back then than there is today of air pollution. Just everybody burning that soft coal, just the whole view to the west was lost. And so the director that took over after Mitchell, Cleveland Abbey, he couldn't see through the telescope. He basically gave up on looking through the telescope, and he started down another hobby of his, which was weather predicting. And while he was up there, he couldn't use the telescope, so he thought, well, what can I do? Well, let me get on the telegraph, and I'll see what's going on in Indiana and Missouri and see what the weather's like. He finds out what the weather is like, and he makes his own predictions as to what the weather is like. It was like the Telegraph 2000, like the Doppler radio, except he was using telegraph. he became the leading weather forecaster in the country. The Cincinnati Inquirer had some of the first weather predictions ever published in a newspaper. And so Cincinnati has two claims of fame, first public observatory and first real meteorologist, we'd say.
Dean Regas, Outreach Astronomer from the Cincinnati Observatory Center, telling you about the history of the observatory that'll be celebrated this weekend at the center. If you have a question about the observatory, want to share an experience you had at the observatory, or have a question about stargazing in general for Dean, just call us at 513-419-7100. So this was a public astronomical observatory, but was there any serious scientific work that happened in those early days?
There was. Ormsby Mitchell was the director for the first few years, and he's known for a few minor discoveries. He discovered a double star that had never been seen before. He has a mountain on Mars named after him. Very minor stuff. They didn't discover any planets or comets, that kind of thing. Part of the deal was all those investors that paid their $25, they had the nerve of coming over and asking if they could use the telescope. And so Mitchell that was part of his frustration. He's just getting ready to view, and then the door knocks, and it's one of his investors. Oh, I guess I'll let you see the telescope. So it kind of, that probably hindered a little bit of what he was doing. But all in all, that was what made us unique, is that it was, here we had this world-class telescope, and the people of Cincinnati could use it.
Well, in 1873, the telescope had to be moved from Mount Adams, I guess, because of the pollution that couldn't
exactly.
That was obstructing the view there.
Exactly. And the telescope was moved to the deep, dark wilderness of this untamed land called Mount Lookout, the new part of town that was just established. And Mount Lookout gets its name because of our telescope as well. So two of the seven hills of Cincinnati are named because of our telescope. And so we've been there in Mount Lookout, the top of Mount Lookout, since 1873. The cornerstone made the move. So the John Quincy Adams cornerstone is there. The old telescope is there. The rest of it is all a newer structure.
Now, what was the old observatory? Did it resemble what we see today, or what did that first observatory look like compared to what we see today?
Yeah, the one on Mount Adams has a little similarities to the current one at Mount Lookout, except for it didn't have a dome on the top of it. It had a roll-off roof, and so it rolled off on these tracks, and then the telescope stuck out of the top of the building, essentially. We recently found a painting of Mount Adams with the telescope, and you could just barely see this little telescope sticking out the top of the roof, which would have been all this wind blowing on it. You know, now we have the domes that are really a lot better. But now the new building here at Mount Lookout was designed by Samuel Hannaford, very famous Cincinnati designer, and a beautiful, beautiful building. And the grounds are just really picturesque. You go up there, you turn the corner from Observatory Avenue to Observatory Place, and you see the building with the silver dome at the end of the street, and you think, oh my, where did I just turn into? This is like it looks like a 19th century street.
513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Yvonne checked in and wanted to ask you to talk about the Friends of the Observatory. She belongs, goes there every night, and it truly continues as a public astronomical observatory.
Yeah, that's our philosophy, is that we want to be open and accessible to the public as much as possible. We have these telescopes that probably should be behind glass. I mean, they are museum pieces, but our philosophy is we use them every day. We use them daytime for solar viewing. We could put solar filters on them. And then nighttime for viewing the moon, stars, planets, that type of thing. And how we're run is we have two full-time employees, a couple part-time employees, and then about 150 volunteers. And so that is our core. The Friends of the Observatory really keep the telescope running, because as much as it seems like I live there at the observatory, I'm there night and day, it's really the volunteers that run the place and keep us open, because there's pretty much something going on there every single day. And it's volunteers and the Friends of the Observatory that run this. And so we still always welcome new folks. If you're interested, fired up about astronomy, you want to get involved somehow, help out with our public programs, we're always looking for people to do that. And of course, we go back to Ormsby Mitchell's days and welcome donations. That's what keeps us going to this day.
And you can find a link to the Cincinnati Observatory Center's website and more information about getting involved in the Friends of the Observatory and all that's happening on our website, wvxu.org. Any other neat historical facts about the observatory?
Well, the other thing, we kind of aren't sure exactly where we rank as the oldest telescope in the world. In the United States, we're the oldest telescope in the United States. There's no doubt about that. But in the world, we have yet to find one that's still open to the public that's older than us.
A lot of them under glass.
They are under glass, exactly. There's Galileo scopes, there's other scopes. But as far as we can tell, we're still the oldest. So I say we're the oldest in the United States, but I've come up with a new name because I've been around to a lot of observatories. And our telescope is the most beautiful telescope in the world. There's no doubt. I've seen a lot of telescopes, and ours is definitely the most interesting looking, beautiful telescope. And so we'd love to have people come check it out.
Dean Regas, the outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory Center, co-host of Stargazers on PBS. After a break, he'll talk about the Meet a Meteorite event on Saturday evening and about the film Gravity and Neil deGrasse Tyson's rant about the science of that blockbuster movie. You can be part of the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, emailing talk@wvxu.org, posting on Facebook, or tweeting @917WVXU. Cincinnati Edition, back after a break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purcell. Ed Humes discusses his book, Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash, with Thane Maynard in about 20 minutes on Cincinnati Edition. But right now, you're stargazing with Dean Regas, outreach astronomer with the Cincinnati Observatory, the observatory marking the 170th anniversary of the laying of the cornerstone at its original location on what was then Mount Ida and became Mount Adams. They're marking that occasion on Sunday evening with a special event. And on Saturday evening, it's Meet a Meteorite at the Observatory Center, now located in Mount Lookout. you have a question for Dean about anything astronomical, you can pass it along by calling 513-419-7100. Lots of astronomy fans in the tri-state, Dean. Some are bringing their meteorite collections to the Cincinnati Observatory this Saturday evening for Meet a Meteorite. Tell us what's happening there.
Yeah, so Saturday night from 7 to 9 o'clock, we're going to be open. We're going to have some of the best meteorite collections from around the tri-state. These are all volunteers. These are all people that just collect these items, and they are quite impressive. We did this last year, and we had probably over 100 meteorites over there. This time, we're going to have even more. There's going to be meteorites from asteroid belt. We're going to have some meteorites that came from the moon, that came from Mars. There are these really metallic ones you can see under microscopes. You can see these glassy ones, and they are just truly out of this world items. So you can actually see them, touch them, and even purchase some. We're going to have a lot of them for sale as well, too. So you can walk home with a piece of outer space. It's pretty cool.
Well, I wanted to ask about finding meteorites because, you know, if I was walking through a stream bed, I'd look down and it looked like any other rock. But I do know the big fireball that happened over Russia, you know, they found a hole in the lake. And just a week or two ago, they went and recovered, went diving and recovered this huge
piece. Big piece, yep.
Yeah, a big piece. How do you find a meteorite?
It's very rare. It's very rare. In fact, we get a lot of people bringing their meteorites to us, in quotes. I did air quotes. You couldn't see that. But they bring these rocks to us, and they say it fell from space. And every single one of them, not one has been an actual meteorite. They are incredibly rare. There's only been about a dozen to 13 meteors that have fallen in Ohio ever.
Really?
And so it's very, very rare to have a meteorite. And, oh, by the way, on Saturday, probably about 10 or 11 of the 13 are going to be at the observatory. our member is obsessive. He's got them all. And so you can see those. And but it's very rare to find them. The easiest places are Antarctica, where they land on top of the snow. You walk around. Anything on top of the snow must have come from above. Same with northwestern Africa on the Sahara Desert, same place. But Russia has been hit recently by the big one, and it made that hole in the ice in the lake, and now they dredged it up, and it is one big piece of rock they got. So it's very cool to see these things.
You know, you mentioned some from the asteroid belts, some from the moon, some from Mars. How do you decide where they're from?
You have to analyze them chemically to figure out exactly where some of them are from. The moon rocks we know pretty well because the Apollo astronauts brought back moon rocks, and we can match them up chemically. Their signatures are very similar. And same with the Mars rocks. We don't have any actual Mars pieces, but we have the rovers on Mars. We have the orbiters that can tell the composition of these rocks. And so they match up to Mars real well. And so recently there's been some debate about a rock that looks like it might be from Mercury, but the jury's still out on that one. But there could be, you look around on the ground, there could be rocks from Venus, rocks from Mercury, rocks from Mars. You wouldn't be able to tell very easily, that's for sure. It takes a lot to be able to pick one out.
Neil Gaiman or was it Carl Sagan who said, well, we're all made out of stardust anyway. So
that's right. Look
you're
inside.
You're walking
of you.
Around.
You're walking around. Everybody around you's got it too.
Roger from Englewood. Good afternoon. You are on Cincinnati Edition.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Dean about the comet, which is due in, to peak right around Thanksgiving. And can we see the thing now? And can we watch it as it grows?
Well, we're hoping. Everybody's got their fingers crossed about this one. It's been a lot of hype about it. It's called Comet Ison, ISON, and it will be coming closest to us around Thanksgiving. You want to look in the morning sky right before the sun rises. Right now, it can't be seen with the naked eye, and it probably will be a couple weeks before we could see it like that. I'm picturing around November 21st, 22nd through the 27th. That might be the best time to start looking for it. And then after it goes around the sun, it'll be visible in the morning again, starting around December 1st for that next couple weeks. But we're not sure how bright it's going to be. It's kind of overhyped right now. So we're trying to lay low with the comet. We don't want to scare it away, but hopefully it'll be really bright. We'll find out.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, so look in the mornings. We'll start to see it maybe in a few weeks.
Thank you for your call, Roger. Greatly appreciate it. And then I was going to make that transition to say astronomical events that are happening right now, and the Comet Ison is in the headlines. I know I've seen some interesting photos that people have been taking through telescopes. And you have to admit, though, first of the year, you were talking big time about this comet.
Coming on Thanksgiving.
Yes, coming on Thanksgiving is going to be the comet of the century. And now, yes, everybody's become quite meek and quiet.
Well, luckily, I'm a historian. I'm a student of astronomy history, and I've known that comets are notoriously fickle creatures. And so I have not bought into the comet of the century thing. I always say it might be good. It may show up. It might. But I also remember we haven't had a good comet in 16 years, and I've seen dozens come and go between that time where people say, oh, it's going to be great. Just get ready. And I get my hopes up, and then dashed.
Yes.
So ISON, I have low expectations. I'm not a morning person. So if I have to get up in the morning to see this, it better be good. That's for sure. So I'm going to wait to see how good it'll be. And we'll see right around just before Thanksgiving, we'll see what it looks like.
I think I touched on a news report, a news story online somewhere just recently that had an astronomer saying in the pictures that they're looking at that the nucleus seems to be holding together. That was the fear, that as it approached the sun, it would begin to break apart, and that would diminish its extravagance, if you may. But I hear that the latest reports are the nucleus is sticking pretty much intact and might really put on a show.
We're waiting for it to really erupt, and so we'll see if that actually happens. It's slightly less bright than we thought it would be at this point, but again, comets do anything whenever they want for whatever reason. We're not quite sure. There was a good one a few years ago called McNaught that was terrible for us. We didn't get to see anything. And then it went around the sun and then had this big eruption of activity. Of course, by that time, you could only see it in the southern hemisphere. So we missed it. So who knows what ISON might be good before. I made the wild guess that it was going to be better before. But now I'm kind of thinking it might, when it swings around the sun, it's going to really heat up a lot, and it might expose different areas to the sun, and so it might be better after, if it survives. That's the question.
Yeah, breaking up near the sun. Where is it right now? It's out near Saturn or something? I'm trying to remember.
It's closer to us than Mars is, so it's getting there. So we only have a few weeks until it's going to be closest to us, and then another week, and then it'll be closest to the sun. And it's going to be within 1 million miles of the sun's surface, which is incredibly close for a comet. So it's actually going to go through the corona of the sun. And if you want to place bets, will it survive? Will it not survive? I don't know. I don't know what the odds are on that, but it's not. It could be 50-50 if it makes it. I don't know.
Any other astronomy happenings in the near future that we should be aware of? With the comet ISON there around Thanksgiving, first part of December, what else is happening?
Well, we do have the Leonid meteor showers coming up. That's the annual meteor shower around November 17th or 18th. This time around probably won't be real good because the full moon will be up at the same time. So that washes out a lot of the meteors. But like you said, we've had a lot of fireballs visible in the sky lately, mm-hmm. and a lot more people are out watching the skies. And so even on the 17th and 18th, get out there and take a look at the sky, and maybe you'll see a couple of the meteors streaking across. And if nothing else, maybe you'll see a stray fireball too. This week will probably be a real good week to look for the moon. And also it'll be right next to Venus. This is the time of year where we get UFO reports that people see Venus in the sky and they think, oh, it's a UFO. And in a couple days, the moon is going to be next to Venus too. So everybody out there, if you see a bright light next to the moon, it's not a UFO. And it's probably the planet Venus. It's still out there. So check that out.
Dean Regas, outreach astronomer with the Cincinnati Observatory Center, talking about the history of the observatory, celebrating the 170th anniversary of the laying of the cornerstone on Mount Adams. And this weekend on Sunday, on November 10th, the date it happened, and Meet the Meteorite on Saturday night at the Observatory Center in Mount Lookout. And meteor rights and meteor wrongs. You say a lot of people come in and bring you a rock and say, this must be, this has to be a meteorite. What is it most often?
Most often it's industrial refuse. It's slag. So it's leftover parts from smelting, from this rock that looks like it's been melted and it's got all these holes in it. Sometimes it even floats in water, and that's never a good sign if it floats in water. but yeah, that's what it is most often. And it is interesting. We get there's also some other stories we get that people say, I've had this rock in my family for generations. My grandma's grandma saw this when it fell to Earth and it hit somebody's barn, and then they picked it up, and now we have it. So I want to know, is it a meteorite? And it, you know, it kind of breaks our hearts to say, no, it's not. Sorry, Grandma gave you a rock. But it's, you know, we're always hopeful. And I always get my hopes up sometimes when people bring them in. But, oh, shoot, they never are. They never are actual meteorites because they're such rare materials.
513-419-7100, Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You said only 13 meteorites have been found or have fell on Ohio. And I mentioned the meteorite or the fireball in Russia where they actually tracked down the meteorite, you know, after it happened. And you hear a lot about things falling on Russia. Is that why Russia and not Ohio?
Well, size. It's all size. I mean, Russia's gigantic country. It's, you know, you take surface area. I mean, so by far the most meteorites would be falling in the ocean because the ocean covers more of the land. So there's, you know, probably meteorites down below the ocean. Russia is the biggest country, so they get the most. Although Canada, I've heard, is also right up there too. Canada, big land mass. So by area, well, these countries are bigger, so they get more hits. However, one thing we found about Russia is the one that in February landed in this place called Chelyabinsk. And I thought that name sounded familiar. And we looked into our safe down below where we have some of our meteorites. And one of the meteorites said it came from Chelyabinsk in 1947.
Really?
And I thought, are you kidding me? They got hit twice? How unlucky could that be? I mean, or lucky, I guess they could. But Chelyabinsk is this gigantic area. It's not like you know, Ohio. It covers a large area. So the region is Chelyabinsk. But yeah, so they've been hit twice.
What is most misunderstood about meteorites, despite the fact that people think they found one and it's industrial slag instead?
Mm-hmm. Well, one is that, I guess one is the negative is that some people think they're radioactive or something like that. They're very dangerous rocks. You can't have them around or something like that, but absolutely not. They're not radioactive at all. There's not really any of those isotopes in any of that thing. And then the other is that they're going to get incredibly rich off of it. That they bring in their rock and they're like, all right, that's it. College is paid for my kids. Not quite. They are valuable, but they aren't that valuable. They're special rocks that have meteorites that have little pedigrees to them. So there's some that have backstories, that have histories. If a meteorite has a hole in it, that's extra bonus. If it hits something, that's a plus. If it killed something, that's even more so. And it's sad to say, but we have one of those. We have one of the rarest meteorites is one of a slice of one of the rocks that killed a cow in Venezuela. And so that increases the value of the rock if there's a backstory. So back in a while ago, there was a lady's car that was hit by a meteorite and dented her car really good. Her car is now on display in a museum. And so I'm just waiting. I hope one hits my car. It'll only increase the value of the car.
You need a new car, too.
Well, I need a new car, but I mean, I'll be able to get that, I think.
513-419-7100, Cincinnati Edition on 91.7, talking with Dean Regas from the Cincinnati Observatory. Linda from Mainville on the line. Good afternoon, Linda.
Hello.
Hi. You have a question for Dean here?
Yes, I do. I'm listening to the show and was particularly interested in the segment on the comet Eisen because Eisen was my maiden name. So I'm wondering if you could tell me how the
Eisen.
Comet got that name.
How is it spelled for you?
The same.
I-S-O-N? Wow, that's interesting.
Pronounced Eisen with, you know, more of an I-N to it. But spelled the same, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, Ison, I always say it Ison, even though nobody really knows how it's pronounced, because it's short for International Scientific Optical Network. So it's actually an acronym for that. It's a group of telescopes around the world that have been looking for meteors and asteroids, and they actually stumbled on this comet. So it's less romantic, unfortunately. But now we could associate with you. How about that?
Absolutely, because I am.
Well, what's Eisen or White's Eisen for you? What ethnicity is that?
Well, from my understanding, it's an adaptation of a Scottish name.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So, you know, my grandmother has some family tree information that goes back to England, Scotland. Origins.
Well, interesting. Well, maybe this will be your comet then. I think this sounds good. I hope it shows up really nicely.
I do too. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda. Appreciate it. Philip tweets he photoed the fireball last month, fireball that came across Indiana and Ohio. Does the observatory offer programs on how to take photos of the night sky?
Most definitely. And if you've got a photo of it, definitely send it over to us. We'd love to check it out because we like to share it with other people, too. But we have a lot of great astrophotographers in our membership. And they take pictures of the sky. I mean, they rival Hubble telescope pictures. We have a calendar that they took pictures of every month, and it's just amazing. Give us a call, and we'll be able to set something up. We're still trying to figure out the dates on when the astrophotography workshops are going to be. But, yeah, our members are some of the best in the country.
And Philip, you can, instead of tweeting, I know you can visit the Sensei Observatory Facebook page and probably pass along the photo that way, too. Well, we just have a few minutes left here, Dean, and a space movie was number one at the box office this weekend. It was not Gravity.
It wasn't.
And no, it was Ender's Game, based on the books by Orson Scott Card. Gravity, though, still at cineplexes everywhere. And back when it was released, renowned astronomer and former guest on Cincinnati Edition, Neil deGrasse Tyson, went on a Twitter rant to diss some of the science in the movie. What did you think of Gravity, and did you yourself sense some egregious scientific errors?
Well, luckily I was warned ahead of time to don't be so skeptical of everything on there. There's going to be some errors and that type of thing.
It's Hollywood.
It was Hollywood. It was a very enjoyable film, very action-packed, that's for sure. I mean, you felt like you were in space. The way they filmed it, it gave that impression. And so that's the plus that I will give it. Sure, there were some laws of physics broken and whatnot, but that's not what the point of it was. It did highlight, what it was like to be in space. And I think that's the real thing, is that there is a little glamour associated with space travel, that it's really not the most glamorous life up there. It's hard work. It's dangerous. And so that part I really appreciated.
Well, I know Neil, and I have some of his tweets here. Mysteries of Gravity. Why anyone's impressed with a zero-G film 45 years after being impressed with 2001, A Space Odyssey. I think the special effects have come a long way, baby.
Oh, boy, it was not even close. I mean, sure, 2001 is probably going to go down as one of the best scientifically accurate and astronomical accurate films. So this is not in that realm, but the effects were, I mean, unbelievable. You really did feel like you were there, and just the sense of disorientation as you're flying through space, not knowing where up and down is, that I'd never felt something like that before. There's another tweet, I think, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he said, they should have called it angular momentum instead of
gravity. I was about to bring that up.
Because there were some things as people were flying through space, and then they stopped them. But then when they let go, they kept going in the same direction. And so they did have this thing. Once something gets going, it just keeps going. That's not necessarily the case. Once you stop it, it stops. So he was right about that part, at least.
Yeah, angular momentum, his tweet said, FYI, angular momentum, the tendency once set rotating to keep rotating unless another force acts to slow or stop it. And he did quibble a little bit with some of the scenes where George Clooney and Sandra Bullock are attached by a rope, and they kind of pull and comes right over. But, it wasn't always there.
No, it's true. And then the fact that you could go from one spaceship to another spaceship in orbit, very, very difficult, unless it was under some ideal conditions where they were that close to each other, which apparently never happens. But, you got to have somewhere to escape, I guess, up in space. But the real astronauts, that's the thing that highlights the real astronauts. There is that real danger of debris flying and hitting you at 18,000 miles an hour. And there's not much you can do about it. And, that's the thing. Our astronauts are brave men and women because there are no escape pods, really.
And that's what was what sort of struck me is how fast things seem to move in the movie. Where usually when you're seeing the space shuttle or used to see the space shuttle approaching the ISS, you know, it's oh so slow, but they're going 18,000 miles an hour.
Exactly. Yeah. Relative to each other, they're going only a few miles an hour. And so they get real close. But then if you're watching from down on Earth, they are zooming around. So The other cool thing about the movie is they did highlight the things that are up there in space. The International Space Station, which you can see, it orbits around the Earth every 90 minutes. The Chinese Space Station is going around every 90 minutes, too. And so these are one of the other things that stargazers look for. On a clear night, sometimes you can see these really bright satellites going overhead, and they are really cool to see.
Now, I think we had one in Cincinnati here just a few weeks ago.
Yep, even a few days ago, it was a big space station pass. Went straight overhead. It was almost as bright as Venus. And so if you see a satellite, it's a steady light. It takes about 5 minutes to go from horizon to horizon. So pick that speed, no blinking, and you're probably looking at satellite.
I'm often mistaken for a plane, but boy, I remember seeing the space station go over a couple of years ago, I think. And that does give you a sense of the speed that it's moving as it goes across the sky.
Yes, it is really cooking. And people ask, can we get it, the telescope on it? And we can't keep the telescope fast enough to move with it. I've been trying with the little portable telescopes. And so you can look and you can actually see the solar panels when it comes through the view through the telescope. So it's kind of cool. And then we just wave. They're up. There's people up there.
So besides these special events happening this weekend, when else can folks see things at the Cincinnati Observatory there in Mount Lookout?
Yeah, well, we're open most Thursday and Friday nights. We just recommend calling ahead of time and seeing what's on the calendar. Each season has a different thing about it. We're now into Venus season. It's going to be hanging around all the way through about New Year's. And then we'll have Jupiter coming around in 2014, Mars coming back again, and Saturn, of course, always the best with the rings. But I think for me, looking through our telescope, it's the moon. You see the moon, you see the craters of the moon, and it lights up your eyes, it lights up your whole face. It's really amazing to see. And so we hope that if people haven't seen through a telescope, you got to check it out.
Well, thanks for sharing, Dean. Greatly appreciate it. And thanks for being here on Cincinnati Edition.
My pleasure. Keep looking up, everybody.
Dean, outreach astronomer from the Cincinnati Observatory and co-host of Stargazers on PBS, Dean Regas. You can learn more about the Meet the Meteorite event Saturday evening at the Observatory and the Sunday evening special event marking the 170th anniversary on WVXU.org. And by the way, Neil deGrasse Tyson will be on the Takeaway with John Hockenberry coming up here in about 15 minutes as well. From the stars to the garbage can at the curb, Ed Humes talks garbology with Thane Maynard. After a short break, I'm Mark Purcell, and this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7.